Okay, well, we haven't really planned very much, have we?
No, not really.
So we're kind of just going to start and see how it goes. And if you see us droning, not waving, then do feel free to you know, stretch out a hand to us. But otherwise, we will come to you. You know, once we feel that we've talked ourselves out, we'll turn over to you for any comments or questions you have on the book. I'm going to kick us off, really, just by asking you about Anna Freud. In the Anna Freud room next door, we have your installation, your arrangement of Anna Freud's archive boxes. And she does seem to be, you know, a presiding spirit over your work. Sophie just mentioned the residency here. And she seems, in direct but also very oblique ways, to haunt the various pieces of work. So could you say a bit about how you came to make the work and the relationship to Anna Freud?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, to start at the very beginning, I think it was in 1999 that I first sort of felt this desire to work with the museum here, and that was when I saw the Sophie Carl exhibition, The Appointment, which also had a beautiful book published to coincide with the show. And that exhibition somehow really touched a nerve, and it was also the time, and I probably shouldn't say that, but that was also the time when I started my own analysis. So those were the really two key moments, seeing this exhibition here by Sophie Carl and starting my analysis and starting an MA in photography in London. And ever since then, I thought that this is such an incredible venue for contemporary art, and it is such an incredibly moving place to be and to come, to visit and to frequent. And I came back ever since many times and over the years, but I could never imagine really to do a photography exhibition here, because it's all, it's there's not a lot of wall space. Well, there is, turns out, but I always thought there wasn't a lot of wall space, and I always thought sculpture works really well here, and installations like Sophie Carl's, you know, it's so I just endlessly admired her approach and her intervention. And so I thought, I couldn't imagine ever working here as a photographer, and until my work began to change, I guess, and until my work began to become smaller and less sort of rigid, I guess. And then it was really a lot later that I understood that Anna Freud had lived here for such a long time. You know, I always thought this is all about Sigmund Freud, and then when I found out that it was actually Anna Freud that lived here for a huge amount of time compared to him. She was here for nearly 44 years, whereas Sigmund Freud only lived here for about a year, or less than a year before he died. And so I got really interested in that, and I thought, well, how come we don't feel her presence in the house? And then this Anna Freud project was launched, and along with that came the invitation for an artist in resident, and I was lucky enough to be that artist in resident, and that's where it all began. Yeah.
It's funny, actually, what you make me think of something that I hadn't thought about and wasn't going to ask you about, but, you know, there are obviously many possible allusions and references you can hear in the word shadow, but you're talking about Anna being in the shadow of Sigmund, and the fact that, although this is very much her house, really, much more than his house, when we think of the Freud Museum, there's only one Freud that we're thinking about.
Yeah. There's plenty of Freuds, I guess, but
it's definitely not the other Freuds.
Yeah.
photography. It isn't a medium I think Freud wrote about at all. And there is, you know, one line of thinking or response that might react by saying that photography is, if you like, the least psychoanalytic of artistic media. Now, what do I mean by that? I guess I mean that it's interested in the surface. I mean, on a very superficial interpretation, it's interested in the surface of things. It's interested in exposure to the light, in bringing things into visibility. And psychoanalysis is more about what's concealed underneath the surface. Now, of course, photography can also talk about what's concealed underneath the surface. But it seems to me that one of the things that you're trying to do with, in particularly the two series of photographs is think about how photography might, I'm not going to say be psychoanalytic, but might enter into the spirit of psychoanalysis.
Interesting question. Well, I guess when I talk about photography, I can really only talk about a small part of photography that I'm mostly familiar with, which is to do with portraiture. And especially if we think about portraiture and the history of portraiture, and there's something, it's all about surface, and it's all about what we read into it. And I've always believed that there's no truth or essence to be read from a portrait, especially not a photographic portrait. But I think what is really interesting is what we bring to it and what we gain from it. And obviously there's a lot to gain from portraiture, otherwise it wouldn't be still such an incredibly popular medium, genre. And I think it's what's concealed which is so interesting, and it's what the portrait conceals is what I'm trying to get at or touch upon. I don't think you can get at it, but you can sort of allude to it. And maybe the silhouette is the closest I've ever come to this kind of surface, which is so obviously impenetrable, and yet it is so rich with, I don't know, I can't say it very well. Let's go back a step. So when I think about my work in terms of the last 20 years, I've started off, and a lot of you who I recognize here know my work from 10 years ago maybe, and it was always flooded with light. You know, I've used a lot of flashlight, and I was always interested in having no shadows whatsoever, and really creating an even light, almost scientific, and for a number of reasons. And now I've come to a point where I'm almost doing the opposite. I'm not even lighting the subject at all with the silhouettes. The Laments is the work downstairs in the dining room, and the Sessions is the work in the hallway. And in both cases, the subject has not been lit from the front. So it's actually, the subject is immersed in darkness, and only the wall is lit. So I feel like I've come closer to my subject by using less light, is what I want to say. Right. Yeah,
that's really striking. I mean, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking of that series of yours, which of course you must have had in mind as well, of the people who you photograph on the threshold of waking. They've just woken up, and you snap them, and they're all wearing white. And as you say, there is the kind of the setting of the photographs is quite clinical, really. It's white, white background, white clothing. And yet you're actually capturing people in terms of kind of the daily inner life is probably the most vulnerable point in the day. So there is this exposure of vulnerability in that early series. Now, when we come to the Laments series, the women are all in darkness, and, as you say, very inaccessible. And yet, I wouldn't say that the difference between them is that one is very kind of exposing and intimate and confessional, and one is is very kind of oblique and indirect. Maybe you were saying this just now, but there's something very intimate about the portraits, and it has something to do, I think, with the minimal illumination in them. I mean, you haven't chosen to make them completely inaccessible. There is something of the contours of the face, there is some feature of the skin or the eye or the eyelashes, but something kind of just presses forward towards the light and allows us to see some fragment. And somehow that little revelation feels all the richer, all the more kind of generous for being so minimal. I don't know if you see it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I started working with the silhouettes, and that was back in 2012, after... It's actually... The interest in the silhouettes began during my residency at the V&A in 2011, when I was looking at not only at miniature portraits, but also at silhouettes, small silhouettes and plumbagos. And but I could never really find a way into the silhouette work until much, much later, 2014. And I guess it's because initially I made silhouettes that were very stark, black and white, and almost like cut out, you know, reminiscent of, you know, just the paper cutouts. And it's only through time that I realized that they became much more three-dimensional and sculptural if I would balance the light more carefully. And I actually introduced a tiny bit of digital manipulation later on. So the silhouettes you see in the dining room are, although they're photographed with analog film, they were later then worked on in the digital darkroom, the ones in the dining room. So I worked together with someone, a digital retoucher, and to just really keep the highlights I want to keep and to let things disappear in the dark that I really wanted to disappear, let disappear in the dark. So it was a lot more controlled than my early experiments. And also I think I was trying to get a silhouette that is slightly more sculptural rather than a flat 2D silhouette. I was hoping to find a way of getting the silhouette to be more 3D, which is also, I guess, the head is kind of shaped and molded in every silhouette, which is quite important. So there's actually they're wearing a cap which is stuffed with bubble wrap. So I was able to mold the head while they're sitting for the portrait, which was very important and very, it felt like it was sort of, I could really tell I really have an issue with photography and I'm really desperately trying to do something that is tactile and, you know, more hands-on.
And of course, the women in the photographs are women you know.
Yeah, the women in the photographs, they're all close friends, and some of them appear twice. One of them appears three times, and I appear as well twice in the 15. The 15 are in the book, but only three of them are in the dining room. And yeah, should we talk a little about the laments? So yeah, the laments, I guess, is. I think it was during the Lament, when I made this Lament series, that I was reading your book. And it was during that time that I was sort of, I was an artist in resident here at the Freud Museum, and I was looking through the Anna Freud archives, and if you go to the exhibition room, you'll see in the display case, oh, here it is, over there. You don't have to go. It's just behind you. in that display case, is the Anna Freud archive, and there's 45 boxes, and they contain all her paper work. Obviously, there's a lot more, but this is the essential Anna Freud archive, the papers. And within those boxes, and I, I didn't look through all of them, but I read through the ones that I read through a lot of the letters, and it was the letters actually that moved me the most when I was looking through her archive, and especially those written by Dorothy Burlingham, who, I don't know if all of you know about Dorothy Burlingham, but Dorothy was Anna Freud's lifelong partner and colleague and friend, and she also lived here for many, many years until her death. And so I read her letters, and they were really evocative, and it was those letters and previous letters I had read in a collection of Eva Rosenfeld's letters to Anna Freud that I realized there was a really strong connection between Anna Freud and these women, and a really, really strong bond, and it somehow chimed with the bond I had with my best friend in Germany, who sadly passed away in 2009. So what I'm saying is that the Lament series is a homage to this friend who's no longer with us. She was an analyst for young children, young people, not young children, young people. And I guess eventually all that, all these sort of experiences and emotions came together in the Lament series. Mm. Mm. Like you put it all into a bullet, into a Nutri-Bullet, and then it comes out at the end.
I really didn't expect you to make that analogy.
I do like it, though.
I like it, too. I think. Although I find everything that comes out of the Nutri-Bullet, I have to say, unpalatably disgusting.
I know.
That's for another evening.
I read in The Guardian, it looks like something you go over the sifts with the Thames.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But, and about as edible. But anyway, so, sorry, we were just about to get serious. I don't know what all the laughter means. But anyway, there is this kind of very powerful sense of personal investment. Again, not remotely confessional in the Lament pieces. But I think it's very important that you don't have to have that. Absolutely don't have to have that information. But we both use this title, Invitation to Frequent the Shadows. And the invitation, I suppose one way of understanding it, is an invitation to enter into your own relationship to the work. They are images that I think solicit very different, or elicit very different responses, reactions, in everyone who's going to look at them. And I just kind of earwigging conversations in front of the work at the opening on Friday night, I was quite struck by this, that people were kind of having very personal associations to it. Not necessarily something that requires an immediate response. The other piece that I wanted to ask you about, because again, it's part of this whole motif, really, of photography, safety, is the light piece in the study, which is called
Save Light.
Save Light. That's what I thought. It's one that sort of, for me, evokes a lot of different responses and associations all at the same time. There is definitely a kind of, it transfigures the room, and it makes it very safe and very cozy. And at the same time, it does exactly the opposite. It evokes associations, fairly obvious ones, with red lights and with Sigmund Freud's life's work, with the opposite of safety. And it just got me thinking, really, about how safety is
very, particularly in Anna Freud's work and in her practice, safety was incredibly important. Creating safe spaces for the child. But even in the kind of language used in the consulting room, you know, her big argument with Melanie Klein, as far as child analysis was concerned, was that one should be very, very cautious about the kinds of language one used for fear of turning the analysis into another, into a repetition rather than a working through of the trauma. And I wonder how much this is on your mind, both sort of the references in psychoanalysis to creating a sense of inner safety and security, but also the way, of course, that it enters into very painful, very vulnerable, quite dangerous territory. Because that seems to be present, kind of almost directly referenced in the Safe Light piece, but also in the sessions, which are the extraordinary fragmentary pieces that that cover the walls of the stairwell.
Safety. Well, I suppose I have thought about safety in on many different levels, but not. I guess the first thing to address your sort of comment is that the study for me has always been an enormous challenge in terms of what am I going to do in the study. You know, I'm working with photography. It's two-dimensional. You know, what are you going to put in the study? And so I went through hundreds of ideas of what photographs I will put in the study, and or will I have more light boxes in the study, or, you know, what does that mean? And, or, you know, and then eventually thinking about an installation with photographs in the study. And so, to tell you the truth, it took me a long, long time to surrender to the fact that I can't see any of my photographs survive in the study. And so I said, okay, then what else is there with photography? And obviously light. And then from light, I thought about what kind of light, and then the dark room, you know, the work, the sessions here in the hallway are all made in an analog dark room, which means I was in a, for more than, for almost a year, I spent in this room with red light, you know, over me, and this kind of, like we said before, it's like a, it's not womb-like really, but it has all these associations, and it's like a underwater aquarium space filled with this sort of illogical red light, which is safe because it protects the print from being exposed. But it made me ponder the psychoanalytic environment and this space, you know, where you go as a patient and you feel safe, and well, you're supposed to feel safe, and because if you wouldn't feel safe, you wouldn't establish a trust relationship, and your analysis wouldn't really work. So safety or feeling safe is quite important, and so I wanted to bring some of that feeling of being in the dark room into the study and this kind of creative space, and this, you know, which is also the couch. You know, it's a very creative space. You have to be very creative, and you have to kind of surrender, and I feel like that slightly happened with the sessions. I was sort of surrendering to my medium being and its limits, but I just completely drifted off your question.
That's the idea.
Yeah, so the red light, for me, it was the only way to work with that space, which is so incredibly rich, and, you know, Freud's study. I mean, people come from the whole world to see Freud's couch.
And break down in tears.
And break down in tears, and so there's an aura, which is very, very difficult to puncture, and, I mean, I have seen it very successfully punctured by a number of artists, but I just felt like I mean, ideally, it would have been a completely red space without, you know, the red, the white bulbs are slightly orangey, which I'm not completely happy with. And I would have had it even darker, but the museum wasn't completely happy with that because people who come from America don't want to have a very, very dark red room. They want to see the couch. So we had to come to a compromise, you know. Mm.
Mm. I don't know why you're pedantic about these things. And there's a sort of there's another reference to danger. I get well. An association I have in the Sessions pieces, which is the tearing itself. Maybe you could say a bit about the tearing as a technique.
Yeah. Okay. So the tearing happened gradually. I initially thought I was planning to make a kind of long-term study with one or a number of children for the duration of like a year or so. And I had no intention to tear anything up initially. And I photographed the same child for a while and then a group of children. And I just eventually felt like I was too comfortable and I had already sort of covered that territory and that ground. And then I thought, I had lots of ideas. I thought, you know, maybe I should give other people a negative to print. And then I thought maybe I should cut out the picture, you know, like a little bit of a Matisse. So I went through all sorts of stages in terms of experimentation until I started to tear the photographs of the children. And then that didn't feel right. And then eventually I decided, It's really about my medium. I need to really, I want to really go with this project to the core of photography, what photography means to me. And rather than working with a child and dragging this poor child into the studio for a whole year again and again, I thought I'm going to use one image and work with that one photograph. And I chose the image you see out there. And then instead of tearing the photograph, which is quite very, very different, I began to tear the photographic paper. So I had small sheets of photographic paper, sort of 10-8 inch, and then I tore them into three or four, and then those pieces again I then tore into shapes and fragments, and that's when I realized the link I was trying to make a link to the fragments, the archaeological fragments that I had seen and admired. And some of them are in the study downstairs, but you can't really see them. They're hidden, literally hidden, not behind the, when you come in, on the left, there's a case, and behind this case, there are some archaeological fragments that Sigmund Freud has been given. And it's those delicate little fragments that look like fragments of cave paintings, you know, of animals. And that's where I suddenly sort of felt like this is the kind of object that I'm visually drawn to. So I began to tear my pieces of paper and then put the paper into the enlarger and then the face of the child was projected onto those little pieces of paper. So each paper is exposed separately, but I never knew exactly where the face of the child would fall exactly. But I had a rough idea, obviously, but it was that small, tiny bit of chance which was really, which became more and more important.
Yeah, chance is very important in that piece, isn't it? Because it struck me that one of the problems with tearing the photograph after it was printed was that, and again, this speaks to psychoanalysis, but there would have been a kind of inescapable conscious intention that kind of crept into, you know, you would have been, how could you not have been strategic about where you did and didn't tear? And it would have had a lot more artifice about it, whereas there is a lot more left to chance.
I know, and that's something I actually struggle with a lot with photography, this, you know, allowing chance to come into my practice and still keeping some control over it, and to keep the balance between chance and control. And equally with the installation here, and with the installation, I had Claire Graphic as a curator, and that was an essential part of this exhibition, because she allowed that chance to come back in the installation, because it was her idea to have the fragments in the hallway. Because I really didn't know where to put the work, and it hadn't occurred to me to use the hallway, and she just had this vision of how they would work, like sort of scattered leaves around it, and I couldn't imagine it until I actually saw it, and it was her sort of vision and you know, this kind of element of chance that would seep into the installation that really made a difference. Again, later with the book, the chance was very important, and you know, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really a steep learning curve for me, and I still have a long way to go.
Shall we say something about the book and then maybe turn over?
Yeah. I think it'd be lovely if you could read a little.
Oh, okay.
A little bit.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. We're hoping that you're going to have questions about the book and how it came about, which is, I guess, partly why we haven't regaled you with this story ourselves. But you may know by now, but it is Fatima's two sets of photographs, the Sessions and Laments, an essay that is a response, a kind of more direct, although associative, response to the work, called Invitation to Brooklyn for Shadows, which is also the title of the exhibition. And that, I mean, yeah, this is something we'll maybe talk about afterwards, but there is this kind of overlapping between us, and this sense that it's difficult with a book in a way to tell what came first. You know, myself or Bettina, the writing or the photographs. Ostensibly, of course, the photographs come first and I'm responding, but it's maybe a kind of more interestingly complicated than that. So I'm just going to read a little bit of both. I'm going to read the first page of the story, the smallest page, and then a couple of paragraphs from the beginning of the essay, and we can turn to questions. So this is the story, which is called The Arrivals. Only after the first photograph came did Wakeman realize how long he'd found the faces of children unbearable to look at. How on the tube the merest hint of a small child opposite, a tiny nylon-padded body propped regally beside her fussing mother, snatches of infantile babble straining over the coach's clatter, would cause his gaze to avert itself sharply. He didn't know why, but neither had he thought much about it until now, as though the question were as unapproachable as the face itself. It was a relief, then, to get off at his station and lose himself in the funereal shuffle to the exit, the short walk to the bank where he worked, the childless world, in which he knew where he was, if nothing else. But the photograph, its reverse side stamped and marked with his neatly biroed initials and address, was not to be so easily eluded. Slumped at the bottom of his short cases for he knew not how long, a few seconds, an hour, a morning, he stared near catatonically at the darkling face, barely perceptible behind a curtain of shadow. Only the wet tear that slid slowly over the corner of his mouth tickled him into awareness. He wiped it, stared quizzically at the moist film spread over the pad of his finger, and left the house. And then this is the beginning of the essay, which is an incident from clinical practice. A few months ago, during the brief interval between evening sessions, I tugged a little too tightly on the cord of my standard lamp. The bulb blew, upon which I realized I'd forgotten to replenish the stock, leaving me to choose between conducting the next session in pitch darkness or under the harsh brightness of the ceiling lights. I made the only choice possible, though I still wonder if it was the right one. The twilight illumination of the consulting room, along with the recumbent position on the couch and the quiet availability of the invisible analyst, is a way, as the jargon has it, of promoting regression. It loosens the grip of the organized, logically consistent mental functioning of our daylight consciousness, enabling the analyson to regain contact with the nocturnal, associative logic of her psychic reality.
Although correct enough, this account misses something. It turns the setting of the analysis into a mere means, a set of preferred material conditions for the real event, of the patient's associations and the analyst's interpretations. But this floodlit session reminded me that there's no isolating the analytic exchange from the physical environment that makes it possible. Okay.
Inconveniently, I forgot to talk about the book. I want to go back to an earlier point almost where you started, which is this notion of whether photography can convey death or not.
Mm.
And it just struck me that actually, if you think about the literally billions, so it's billions now, isn't it, photographs that are taken every year in the world, the vast majority of them are being used for exactly the opposite purpose. They're being used to sort of aggressively, almost desperately promote or project, you know, what Jung, are we allowed to say Jung, by the way?
No, no.
A bolt of lightning would come in. But what
Jung... There's a trap door on the
But what Jung or Winnicott would refer to as a false self. And so it's almost like the vast majority of photography outside of the art world is being used for exactly the opposite purpose. And I don't know what you think about that. Maybe I may have got that wrong, but that's very strange.
Yeah, I mean, it's something... I think you probably responded to in The Private Life, which is a book I wrote, which orbits a lot around the kinds of questions that you're raising. But absolutely, you know, this was one of the aspects of Bettina's work that resonated so immediately with me, because it points to another possible destiny, really, for photography, but one which is absolutely against the grain of the way that the medium is used and abused in contemporary culture. So I think it's probably not a coincidence that Bettina works with this dinosaur equipment, you know, with analog cameras in an old-fashioned darkroom, and is still very much connected to that labour of photography, which, is so at odds, really, with the instantaneousness of the image on the web, on social media, and I think absolutely photography is really the medium through which now there's a kind of profoundly dissociative medium in which we come to conflate ourselves with the pictures we can take of ourselves, and it's almost become a medium for annulling ambiguity, richness, actually, for sort of chasing shadows out of the world.
Perhaps also chasing time out of the world. What I find really, what you touched on, Bettina, is the sort of the length of time, you know, that it takes for the image to appear. So although even dinosaur equipment functions extremely quickly, we're talking about fractions of seconds.
Yeah.
The image only can come about after a huge, very lengthy, sometimes years of process and thinking and sort of being built. I hadn't never really considered the parallel between the description of analysis. You know, one sense of what analysis is a complete, I don't know anything about it, but you know, that the fact that it takes so much time. So that on the one hand we were talking about surface and but on the other it's, you know, it takes forever just to get onto the surface.
But then equally, psychoanalysis seems to take forever, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, there's this parallel.
And you talk about this in great length in your book, about the private life, which is what, you know, the reason why we met is because I came across that book, someone wanting to offer.
Yeah, just how it all happened, your collaboration.
Yeah, I guess it started with The Private Life. I can't actually remember where I saw The Private Life first. I saw it on a bookshelf somewhere, and I can't remember. Anyway, I bought it probably just because of the title and the blurb. And then I read it again and again and again, and I felt like this is, I love the book, but I couldn't completely understand all the gaps and, you know, all the little gaps, and there was something about it that I just really wanted to know more about, and then I it really resonated with those ideas that I was thinking about at the time while I was making the Laments series. And then you gave a talk here. It was a panel discussion, so I came to the panel discussion, and then I suggested that we, I asked you if you ever wrote about art, didn't I?
I think so.
Yeah, and then sort of we started a dialogue from there. Yeah.
And that's how this was born.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, I mean, I can sort of take, you know, if I take, for me, Bettina, yeah, invited me to come and see her work. And kind of was very kind of graciously accommodating, and we could do it here, and you can look at it over email. But I wanted to see it in situ, in the studio, so I wanted to visit her in Hackney. And I mean, anybody who works creatively in any medium will come across people who say, "Oh, yeah, I see a lot of my work in your work." And a lot of the time, you know, you might find yourself saying, "Oh, really? Okay, that's nice." So the thing about Bettina was, I think as soon as I saw the first image, the resonance and the affinity was so clear, and in a way, kind of startling. Not at all that I felt that these books, these images illustrated the book in any sense, but on the contrary, that they...
The book that you were talking about?
Yeah, the private life. I didn't think of it as being illustrative, but this sort of profoundly different expression of the same sensibility, the same set of thoughts, coming from a very different place. And so when we came to do the book, I think, you know, the thing that most appealed to me was that Bettina was very, very clear that if we were going to do this, she didn't want a kind of standard catalogue essay. But that I had to kind of do whatever I wanted, and that it could be as direct or oblique. And then she said to me, "You could even write a short story," which seemed to be quite a spontaneous, random comment, but which immediately again set bells in my head, because it seemed like an opportunity to do exactly that. I think the whole kind of question of priority and the lack of it here is, you know, kind of sequence is really fascinating, because in the book I'm responding to the photographs, but Bettina, you know, the collaboration arose because Bettina responded to something I'd written. And so there is a kind of lovely kind of looping reciprocity about the whole process.
But then you also had this idea which, I mean, it was also, I think, we can't not talk about Andrew Brown here, because the publisher, Art, you know, from Art Books, Andrew Brown, he came along very early on, and I had this, I thought this would be great, you know, this somebody like you who writes freely about your work and my work, but in a very free way and without sort of any direction. At the same time, I didn't really know how it would work, because I thought, you know, I've got these two bodies of work, and then you had this kind of vision that it would work, and then there was this whole length, there was a whole period where I was like, I know it's could work, but I don't know how it's going to work. And I just thought, okay, we'll just float for a while. And then, you know, let alone there was no funding. So there was a real flotation period. I felt like in a flotation tank, which was really not very comfortable for quite a long time. And then you came up with the brilliant idea of writing two pieces.
Mm.
So, and then it kind of fell into place.
Yeah, and we both had sort of separate exchanges with Andrew, and I mean, one can sort of
exaggerate with you know, and make it sound like mere flattery, but there was this kind of very generous gesture at the outset of this project that Bettina and I were going to have equal credits on this book, and then we ended up feeling that actually there should be a third one, because the book is not really edited, it's curated. It's an extraordinary piece of work by Andrew, in which text and image are configured and juxtaposed and speaking to each other in ways that are really quite intricate and very much a result of this third person who's invisible on the cover, but really such a presence in the book that I felt very reluctant to show the people the writing isolated from the book, because I feel that actually, not that it wouldn't necessarily, you know, be readable and stand on its own without the book, but that its kind of fate, its identity is now so much bound up with what Andrew's done with it. So yes, perhaps you could kind of, you know, spirit his name onto the front cover in your own minds.
Have you ever been photographed by the team?
No.
Are you frightened she'll steal your soul?
No. I'll just leave it. I mean, it's something that would be wonderful to happen.
You talked about the sort of analog physicality of the photographic techniques that have been using, but what about the book? As a, you know, because that's also in relation to words, that's also kind of now, you know, to make a book is kind of quite a deliberate gesture.
Yeah.
So can you say something about that from your point of view, about making it, or from both of you, about making a physical artifact?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that Andrew was very kind of emphatic about from, you know, well before we had any sense anyway of what this thing would look like, was that it would be a very beautiful object. That seems very much continuous with what we're talking about in relation to photography, that, you know, that if photography threatens to become a medium of kind of information and content shorn of ambiguity, it was important, you know, I mean, the book in a way threatens a similar kind of fate, that the book as well could become kind of manualized, could become a medium for conveying information. So I think this is keyed into the history of the book as an object, really, as not just as a medium for showing something, whether it's words or images, but as an object in its own right. And I do have a fascination for the book as an object beyond what it contains, but beyond the content that it transmits.
Yeah. Is it your first book?
No, it's my third book. But I think it's by far the most interesting book I've been involved with, and yeah, just simply because it's sort of breaking away from that pattern of, you know, images and then essays and or the catalogue, and I love the, you know, books, photography books, you know, as for what they can do and the potential of them, and, you know, they're affordable and they can cross the ocean in no time, and I don't know, they have a life way beyond us, hopefully. But I thought for the work here at the Freud Museum, I just felt like it had to be more than a book with image and text. And I just think with Andrew, and Josh, it was just the perfect kind of collaboration. And also, I mean, the vision of it being this kind of beautiful object, I think that was your you saw that first before we saw it, and then but then we kind of added to it, you know, and then you know let you know the little the cover and the shininess and but I think it was you that had the vision at the very beginning. Do you want to say something about this?
Well, I mean, of course, it was a response to both of your work. I saw the photos, first of all, and was immediately struck by the sheer beauty, especially of the Levin's portraits. And so, of course, the book needed to reflect that beauty. But we've heard a number of recurring words and parallels and analogies and looping that's the same. You were talking about the looping relationship between your two bodies of work. And really, the book had to take that on board. I mean, there were two sets of factors which were related but separate. Then there were two texts which were equally related to one another and to the photographs but separate. And the challenge was really to try and weave these four separate things together in a kind of loop so that they could be read together as one book but also read as separate strands. And the idea of having two different kinds of typographic treatment. So the short story is presented in a fairly traditional serif typeface that plays with different sizes of words on the page. And then the essay is set in a much more straightforward, conventional way, but in a sans serif. Fairly contemporary typeface. But the idea of doing that was really to emphasize the gaps, you know, the places, the invisible places where meaning is generated, you know, between the words, between the images, where they meet, where they are juxtaposed, the gaps and the folds in between. And just one other thing to say, that of course, it had to be black and white. And the book had to really celebrate the black and whiteness of both image and text. The irony is that full colour printing, in order to get black, is actually not full colour. There is no black. If you have black, just black. So in order to get those red blacks, it's all four colours.
I love this stuff.
And one last thing. My name is actually on the phone. In the form of art books, which unfortunately shares my initials.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's good.
Say one thing, but a couple of comments on another. It's lovely for you, for the people who have seen it, but when you were speaking about the fragments and the rigid edges of the fragments that you read there and things, you know, there are a lot of ways in which the text not only plays, especially with the creative story that you've written, not only with that, but also with some symbols and images that are evoked by the text itself. So, you know, like there are little stairs of words, and it felt very, very much interesting to see that it's kind of, it really worked very nicely in bringing together the images and the, you know, the rigid edges and the sharpness of some words and the flow of certain things. And it was very nice. And also the fact that it's interesting that, you know, that your essay that is more kind of traditional is kind of white, illuminates the black page, while, you know, the very much more poetic, almost maybe feel like a bit of an Edgar Allan Poe kind of mysterious story that isn't with a final that is very controversial, because it seems like a lot of people are missing one thing. Maybe you might want to say that, but it's kind of, it's interesting that whoever has read this story, some people have had a different feel of what would be ending.
Oh yeah.
It's left very open. So even that is a bit in the shadow, like, you know, you're kind of left like, what does that mean? But,
Yes, I've been introduced really to, well, I'm being slightly too. I'm not going to do a spoiler, but there is quite a dark interpretation that people have given to me at the end of the story, which I suppose was kind of a seed planted as I ended it, but not intended as definitive. And I'm afraid I can only be I think it's a shame to be any less vague.
You can be shadowy about it.
I can be shadowy. But yes, the ending is meant to be ambiguous and not to to sort of offer a definitive ending.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, maybe I have two questions. In your previous book, you talk about psychoanalysis as something that people are slightly scared of, still to this date. And I thought that was really an interesting thought. Maybe, do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. It's something to do with the way that psychoanalysis circulates in our culture. Not so much actually in popular culture, because in popular culture the therapist has become a kind of almost innocuously benign figure who always just wants to, you know, support and open up your curiosity and help. But somehow there's something about the classical image of the analyst that survives all that kind of sanitizing that, you know, one thing any analyst has to put up with the rest of their lives when they make the stupid decision to become analysts is that people will say to them stuff like, oh God, you must know exactly what I'm thinking. and, you know, one shouldn't be too self-exposing, I suppose, but it's tempting to say no, and I don't want to. it's a very, very kind of interesting, kind of interestingly religious, really, conception, or shamanic, or something. It's an image of the analyst is somehow endowed with a kind of gift to make the soul completely translucent, to, you know, see through to you and expose your core. And that, I think, is the anxiety that is immediately triggered when you simply tell people that you're an analyst. And I think that people often bring that as a kind of, what in the jargon we'd call a preliminary transference. The preliminary transference to analysis, to the analyst, is, you know, which is basically the idea of the analyst that you take into the room before you set eyes on them, is that immediately you're going to be read, you're going to be not just seen, but seen through. And I think that part of the trajectory of a good analysis actually could be defined as a transference in which, you know, you imagine the analyst seeing through you to one where you more modestly just think of the analyst as seeing you.
But don't you think that maybe some people or patients will come to you and hope that you can see through them?
Yeah, there is that as well. Yeah.
So it would be quite easy then.
Yeah, that's right. And often, you know, they're scandalized when you can't. And you get a lot of implicit and occasionally some explicit kind of what's the good of you then? You know, you don't seem to be endowed with any much greater insight than anybody else that I could talk to in the pub, and you're a lot more expensive. And there's something to that. There's something about starting to understand. I mean, this is something that a journey that every analyst has to undergo. That actually the privileged position they occupy doesn't have a lot to do with their brilliance or their unique insight, but the fact that they're occupying a place, that they open a door on time, that they sit down, that they're available, that they're quiet, and that they're able to respond. This is something on the one hand that absolutely anybody can do, and on the other hand that is incredibly hard work and requires quite a lot of training.
Yeah, what about listening? I mean, that must be difficult.
It is really difficult, yeah. It's difficult.
The art of listening.
Yeah, it is difficult. I mean, God, one could talking is a lot easier than listening. But it's difficult because you have to listen on a certain frequency. And you have to give up a certain notion of purpose of listening. One of the passages I often think that if people read Beyond before they came to analysis, they might not even come to the consultation, because he basically recommends to the analyst that they almost fall asleep, that they enter a state of, I think he says, sleepiness akin to stupor. Now, not everyone takes this counsel absolutely literally. I don't think I fall asleep in all my sessions as a matter of kind of, you know, willed action. But, if one reads him not in terms of kind of manualizing a set of instructions, but as evoking a kind of atmosphere, it starts to make sense. In other words, you have to induce in yourself a state of passive receptivity where you can be surprised by what's coming, rather than process it as though you kind of already know what's being said already. So there is this way in which you have to get yourself into a state where you don't really know what's coming. You don't allow yourself to think you know what's coming.
Just like art.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's absolutely right. I think that's probably what we recognised in one another's work, that same. I mean, you were talking about chance earlier. And chance is, it's not a word that's used much in psychoanalysis. In many ways, it's the cornerstone of psychoanalysis, because, you know, you can walk into a session and, you know, after you've done it for a few weeks, you have no idea what you're going to say. And the analyst has no idea what you're going to say. And you could say absolutely anything, and you end up saying this. That's what Mallarmé called the throw of the dice.
What's your next book? I know you're writing about your next book, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm writing a book about, actually, stupor is very much relevant to it, because it's about states of indifference, apathy, lethargy, and inertia. And it's about the relationship between those states and creativity. And so you can see already the overlaps between psychoanalysis and art. But also, actually, it's about, in the broadest sense, I suppose it's about politics as well. About the rhetoric that that cuts across so much of political discourse today, that demonizes laziness and fecklessness, and that basically devalues those regions of personal experience which are not purposive, which are not active, which are not intervening in the world. And yet anyone
And I don't mean artists, I don't mean writers, I don't mean analysts. Anyone who's remotely in touch with creativity knows where that's where everything happens. So how is it that we have a culture and a kind of broad rhetoric that wants to chase laziness and kind of states of neutrality out of the world, and kind of bludgeon us into manic activity all the time?
Living in London?
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, I mean,
now,
it's it.
A question on that note. Do you think that with the younger generation who are always occupied on a device, that actually that state of inactivity is going to change the way creativity happens? Because often creativity happens when you're in a state of kind of not being present, but they're not present but always doing something.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
how it's going to affect
the state of distraction. Yeah. It's a really interesting question, actually. And not. I hadn't thought about the question from that angle, because I tend to think of distraction as a kind of, you know, another way of firing the cylinders of the mind. But there is another way of thinking about distraction, which is also a kind of interstitial state. You know, Walter Benjamin wrote beautifully about the kind of the distracted cinema audience that's kind of watching but not watching the film. And there is something about that where that can happen. And obviously we are going to have to think, you know, we can't just call the death knell for creativity. We are going to have to think about how creative thinking and relationships to the world enter the cracks, and you know, enter through the cracks of this kind of digital, mania.
I mean, the older generation have had a bit of space, but I think the youth today get kind of, they've got no space. And you see toddlers in a pram going along with their mother's phone, so there's no space connecting in it.
True. But, you know, it's also become more, you know, by now it's a journalistic cliche, isn't it? The couple sitting in a restaurant, on their phones.
Just ask a question. You were talking about chance and this morning work that you in psychoanalysis, and I was thinking about the word frustration as a precursor to desire. Then, what do you think about that as a precursor for creativity? Because you were talking about, you were thinking about what you could put in the student in the study, and not having enough walls in the museum where you could put your artwork. And was there a time that you felt a certain frustration? Oh yeah.
There was more than one time when I felt frustrated. I mean, but I think that's part of it. And I mean, I can't think of one body of work I've made in my life which hasn't included a period of frustration. But I suppose here it was extremely unusually long. And I guess I started thinking about the space 4 years ago, and I started writing proposals 4 years ago, and they've changed and changed and changed and changed again and again, and to a point where, you know, there's a room like this room here is the exhibition room of the Floyd Museum, where half of you are sitting now, and that was for me the hardest room, and I eventually totally gave up on it and made it and decided it won't be an exhibition room for my show. It will be a resource room, a reading room. Because I just felt inspired by the house and by the furniture and by the histories and not by an empty room. And so the only room that I couldn't think of making any work for was this room, because it had nothing of the Freud family. And eventually I decided to carry the archive downstairs and display it as a sculptural installation instead. But yeah, there was a lot of struggle, definitely.
Can I ask what you meant
My next project, well, I'm sort of working on two things, but one is a long-term project with another artist, Sophie Rickett, and we're collaborating on making our own archive from our scrap material from the last 2 decades and future. So we're working on a long-term project together, which is very unusual because I don't collaborate very often with other artists. And I'm working on another sort of exhibition towards in Sweden, but it's a lot less. It feels a lot less intense than this. So I feel like I need to have a little air. I need some time off actually. After this. A void. I need a void.
Does the void seem to be the right place? Shall we fall down the void?
It's approaching.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's embrace it. Yes. Well, thanks everybody for
Thank you.